My name is Caroline Kahoʻiwai Choi in Peters Belsum. I just turned 74 years old, and we are here at the Bailey House Museum in Wailuku. And today is June 27, 2022.
And I am Jocelyn Romero de Mirba. I just turned 60. And it is the 27th still of June 2022, and we are at the Bailey House Museum. So I'm so happy, Caroline, to be able to talk with you and to have had a conversation prior as well. And I would love to have you talk about your names and where they came from and what they mean to you, their story.
Sure. I think everybody wanted to get in the act when I was born. So my dad's side of the family is Hawaiian Caucasian. My mother is Chinese. So my English name, Caroline, is a family name on my dad's side and goes back to my great grandmother. I believe she's the first that I have found in our genealogy with the name Caroline. And they believe that it was a name that perhaps one of the missionaries had given to her. This was in Lahaina, the west side of Maui. My name, Kahoʻiwai, was given to me by my father. And it is also a family name. And it goes back about five or six generations, on the Big Island. We descend through Isaac Davis, who was one of the King Kamehameha's Haole counselors, one of two, he and John Young. And Isaac Davis had a son, George Hueo Davis, who then had, as one of his many children, a daughter named Paneku. And she had a daughter whose name was Sarah Kahoʻiwai Manoa Anakalea. And so the Kahoʻiwai, at least in our family, starts there, but I am told it comes from even further back. My father tells me that Kahoʻiwai translates to the receding waters. And it is the receding waters before a tidal wave. So if you've been involved or know about tidal waves, they go back and back for about a mile or so, and then they come thundering in past the high water mark and cause a lot of damage. And my dad says that person in our family who carries that name tends to be someone of very even temper, not subject to big mood swings. However, if they do undergo this mood swing, mostly like a deep depression or so, it is the sign of an impending natural disaster, like a tidal wave, but also like a hurricane or a volcano eruption or things like that. So those people that know me from time to time will say, well, how are you feeling today? I just heard the mountain erupt on the Big Island. He said, I'm fine on there. But that's where that comes from. And there's at least one in every generation, about four or five generations before me, and then now two generations after me. So my nieces, I have two nieces with the name, and I just got a great grand niece who has the name as well. And Choi In is from my mother's side, the Chinese side. I'm told that the Choi indicates what generation I'm in. In my mom's family, which is the Yim family, Y-I-M. The Yim family was given that name by the emperor back in like 400 BC. We started in northern China and ended up in southern China. And a number of the workers that came here to the islands came from that area. And so all the Yims are related somehow, but they all come through there. So Choi In's translation, I am told, it is golden jade, someone unique, which I think, oh, okay, I'll try to live up to that on there. Unique and unusual. My name Peters is from my dad's side. However, our line only starts from my grandfather. This is my grandfather. My grandfather was born with the last name Kalaikini in Lahaina, Ka'anapali Lahaina side. When he was working somewhere, his employer said that he could not continue to have his Hawaiian surname, that he had to pick an English surname or lose his job. His father's name was Peter Kalaikini, and so they took Peter and put an S on the end of it, and from my grandfather forward are the Peters that are related. Even though there are a number of different Peters families around, I am only related from my grandfather down there. So my brothers, well, my dad was an only child, so that was the only male Peters, and I have four brothers, and then we have four nephews that carry the name. My last name is Belsom, and that's because I married Jack Belsom, who is a retired pastor here on Maui. He is originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, of German and English descent. I have no idea where the Belsom name comes from, but my husband's name is Jack, and he has a twin sister named Jill.
Uh-huh.
And they have to live with that all their lives.
Well, that is an amazing history and a powerful one. I actually am all teared up because I'm so shocked that your grandfather had to change his name or lose his job. Just one more crazy example of the many losses or impositions that came with, you know, colonization, essentially, of a kind.
There's another, well, I shouldn't say there is another. I'm working on a second theory. Now, one thing you need to know is that I did not know I had any connections with Maui or Maui County before I moved here in 1991. Since then, I have been doing some work, some research, some that I stumbled over, some that have been brought to me. But my great-grandfather, so Peter, that I was talking about early, Peter is one of four children of a fellow named Mikona Kalaikini. His wife was Caroline, also known as Kealalaina. Mikona contracted Hansen's disease, and three of his four children got Hansen's disease. The fourth was my great-grandfather, Peter. And back then, it was, having Hansen's disease was something you didn't talk about. And no one ever told me in the family until I got here and found out that these four people were there. And what is ironic is that I had been to Kalaupapa three times before I found out. So I had the opportunity to look for their graves and didn't, because I didn't know. But back then, you didn't tell people you had Hansen's disease or someone in your family had Hansen's disease, because they would basically shun you. They were afraid to get the disease. And I have since found a medical report that studied Mikona, Caroline, and the four children, because it was a time when they were trying to find out how Hansen's disease was transmitted. So here you had a gentleman, his wife, and four children. The wife and one of the children does not get the disease, but the father and three of their children end up with the disease and at Kalaupapa. So it makes you wonder whether the family put a story that was that seemed acceptable at the time on the name, or whether that was truly the reason for changing the family name.
That makes sense. And I mean, the gift is that you know the name. You know your name, your real name.
Yes.
And so the Kalaikinis are all from Lahaina?
Yes. Yes, I can trace it back at least two more generations before Peter to a gentleman named Ioba Kalaikini, also Job from the Bible, so during the time of the missionaries. And I have since found from the Hawaiian Mission House's archives that Joba had been corresponding with Dr. Dwight Baldwin, and the Baldwin House Museum in Lahaina was one that Ioba worked on doing renovations.
Wow.
And there's some correspondence that we have found in the archives for the Hawaiian Mission Society that that contain Ioba's letters to Dr. Baldwin in Hawaiian, and they've translated them into English.
So when you say he was working on it, was he a construction person? What did the family do in general?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but he was either doing the actual work or he was supervising, because the letters were to advise Dr. Baldwin as to the progress and the renovations from there.
Wow. And have you found any properties in that area or artifacts from Lahaina in your family?
What I do know, what I have seen, is something that occurred when my father passed away in 1986. We were cleaning out his things and we found some documents from a lawsuit that was initiated by the state, and my dad never responded to, but it was the state condemning the property that the West Maui Airport sits on. And amongst a number of other owners in the area, the state was going to, by eminent domain, take the property and convert it to the airport.
Was that part of the Pu'ukoli'i camp, or was it close enough to be connected to that?
I think it's close enough. It could have been connected to it. My understanding was Ioba was from Ka'anapali, and there was a Ka'anapali camp I think it was at the beginning. So roughly around where Pu'ukoli'i would have been.
Yeah. There are still many people who remember Pu'ukoli'i as a camp. Mm-hmm. Was any of your family involved in sugar or lived?
I don't know. When I was growing up, the family, on both sides of my family, did not talk genealogy, did not talk about the ancestors. I could understand on my mom's side, this is a picture of my grandmother. She was the only grandparent that I saw growing up, and she died when I was about 8. My mother would tell us that our relatives in China were not accessible to us because it was communist China at the time. Mm. And so she said, do not talk about them. Do not think about them. They are dead. And the rest of the family said the same thing. No use.
Wow.
My aunts would say, no use wasting our time talking about them because we cannot get to them. We cannot talk to them. So they are dead. On my father's side, for whatever reason, no one talked genealogy as well. We knew about my grandfather because we continued to go to the church that he served. And so my dad would mention him.
And what church was that?
That was Kamakua Mauloa Church in Kalihi on Oahu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So he ended up somehow moving from Lahaina.
Yes.
To Oahu.
My grandfather did.
Yeah.
Peter was, so the line through Peter was in Lahaina. Then Peter and his wife, Sarah, had Henry and a couple of other kids. And Henry eventually moves to Oahu. But we don't know why that happened. But it's interesting that the family chose not to let everyone know about their ancestry.
On both sides.
On both sides.
Yeah, that's, as you were saying earlier, probably very indicative of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Some things best not said aloud, although frequently they're said in private.
Yes, I know
maybe
that.
To a certain carrier right, of the information.
Yeah, I remember because both of my parents were the youngest in large mm-hmm. families, that they were, I used to view it as, they were rebels.
Mm.
Just marrying one another made them rebels. My mother was expected to marry a nice Chinese boy, or at least someone that was Asian. And here comes my dad, who's Hawaiian Haole, and you could feel the tension sometimes in our gatherings on my mother's side.
After you were born and everything, your family existed, this tension still existed, that there was this mistake or line crossed or something like
yes.
that?
Yes. They would invite us, and there were times in which we had our own little table to sit at, our
family.
And everyone else were at another table. And I remember, I wasn't asking very nicely, but I asked my dad why we had to go to this one event. And I said, they don't even talk to us, you know. And Dad said, because they're your mother's family, and they invited us, so we're going.
Mm.
And my dad was a proud person, but he also knew that he loved my mom enough that he would do what was necessary in order to keep her in good stead as much as possible with the family. I'm sure that was it. But nobody talked about those things. They just happened, and they just were.
That was very generous of your father.
Yeah. But we knew, even with our friends in school, you know, that the Japanese rarely dated anyone other than Japanese, you know. And I remember we were driving somewhere. Dad was driving somewhere. And he made a comment because he saw this Japanese boy and girl on the street waiting for the bus. But they were sort of holding hands and kind of snuggling with one another. He said, you'd never see that, you know, in amongst the Japanese people. And the kids would probably get in trouble if someone reported back to their family.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I think that's true. I think that even as recent as in my own childhood, my Japanese friends were not supposed to be dating non-Japanese, or their parents definitely didn't like it.
Mm.
So that is still very present. But how did they meet then? What brought them together and made them defy both of their families?
The stories that we heard were mostly from my dad. He said that they met at a dance hall. They had these dance places, I guess, downtown Honolulu. And my mother at the time, well, my mother was already a rebel. She moved out of the house when she graduated from high school, went through secretarial school, and she was working up at Kamehameha Schools, Kapalama, for one of the professors there. And it had a room, I guess, up there.
At the campus?
At the professor's house, or the teacher's house.
Okay.
And I know that because my dad tells the story that they met, and so he was trying to be cool, and so he said he'd escort her home. Well, it was getting late, and the bus stopped running, so they got to the bottom of the hill, and he walked her up the hill, all the way up the hill to her house.
Kind of far.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
And then they started seeing each other after that.
Okay.
So my mom had left her house. She was working, which at the time, it wasn't what was encouraged. That she was supposed to find a husband, but she wanted to do these things. So she moved out, started her job. My dad was already working. He'd been working since he was young. His mother died when he was in third grade or so. And so he said he shined shoes and sold newspapers, but he was supporting himself, and they went out, you know, they each individually went out for a good time and ended up meeting each other.
So the dance hall aspect, was that, I don't know, acceptable or okay for your mother to be doing?
It depends on who you asked. I'm sure her family would have frowned on it a lot, but my mother was going to do what she was going to do.
I love it. So how about that quality in you? Do you have that streak, or are you the more even-tempered Ko'ewai?
I tend to be even-tempered in my personality, but I'm a risk-taker. In my life, have done a number of things that I'm sure others would not have done. I was telling someone recently, I wanted to go to college, and I told my dad, and he said, "Well," he said, "we can't afford to send you to college. You know what you need to do. Now go out and do it." He wasn't going to hold me back, but they couldn't. Mm-hmm. They couldn't help me at all. He also was funny because the first time I went to them, now kids these days, they go to the mainland from when they're like 3 and 4 years old. The first time I went was the summer between my junior and senior years in high school. I got to go to Minnesota to study for the summer. And my dad kept telling me before I left, he said, "Don't go out inside. You can't go to the beach." He says, "You're going to get too dark and they're going to make you sit in the back of the bus." I said, "Dad, I'm going to Minnesota, not Mississippi." He says, "Same thing."
Am I?
I went to law school in Connecticut. He thought I was in Cincinnati for a long time. And I said, "Dad, one's a city and one's a state." And he said, "Well, they both begin with C and they're long."
And in fact, did you have any of that kind of issue, or people either considering you black or treating you differently because you're a person of color? Any of those issues?
Those things happen, but I need to tell you that when I left, one of the things my dad said was, "If people don't like you for who and what you are, then they're not worth having as friends." And he said, "You can do anything you want to do." I went to school at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. At the time, there were 12 international kids. The student population was like 2,200. It is a very Norwegian Lutheran school. Blonde haired, blue eyed. You think I stuck out? Yeah. But it's, you know, I never saw myself as different from anyone else. Carleton College is a liberal arts school in the same town across the river. And during freshman year, they had a dance. And I met a fellow there, and he asked me out. And when I got back to the dorm, more than one of the girls said, "How can you date that black guy?" And he was African-American, which I didn't know, but it didn't dawn on me that it would make a difference. I mean, he was a freshman. He was from Gary, Indiana. He played football. Mm-hmm. He was interesting to talk to, and he asked me out, so, you know. I think in my head, I'm looking out through my eyes, and I see the world around me, but I'm not looking at me. And so I could be blonde-haired and blue-eyed, I guess, if I wanted to be.
But maybe that's your Hawaii part, too.
I think
that
that's...
you didn't pay attention or think anything was odd with that.
I think that's true also, yeah. And then I tended to be study and work in areas that predominantly dominated by men. My undergraduate degrees are in math and physics. I have a master's in physics. In graduate school, there were three women in my physics graduate class. In college, there were two of us women physics majors.
Wow, you're like Patsy Mink.
Oh, I don't know. But
how did you get the school paid for? I mean, they're mainland schools, they're very well regarded, you know, they're even elite, both mm-hmm. schools. Mm-hmm. How did that happen for you if it wasn't from your dad?
Well, I went to Kamehameha. Mm-hmm. I started when it was Kamehameha School for Girls. Mm-hmm. My freshman year, they integrated the classes. Mm-hmm. So the school for boys and the school for girls start taking classes together. That's how old I am. That's old. I think that summer that I spent at St. Olaf in physics, that was a National Science Foundation grant, sort of laid uh-huh. the framework for uh-huh. things. St. Olaf offered me a scholarship that was very good. But in my mind, I thought, I've already been there. I want to go somewhere else. My first choice was to go to Carnegie Mellon in Pennsylvania. And they accepted me, but they couldn't give me any money, and I could not do it. I think I applied to maybe 10 schools. I was uh-huh. afraid nobody would take me, but I got accepted at all of them. And it was just who gave me the best financial uh-huh. package. And so St. Olaf was scholarships and grants.
And was it Kamehameha that sort of made these schools available to you or helped you apply? I mean, in those days, from that big fat book,
yeah,
right? I mean, mm-hmm. it wasn't like the internet or where you could have a screen of, show me, you know, the top 10 physics schools or whatever, right?
Kamehameha had a very good college counselor uh-huh. at the time, so that was helpful. They also had the equivalent of advanced placement courses, uh-huh. So much that when I went to college, I tested out of freshman and sophomore math. I started in my third year math. I ended up, you know, being able to test out of the first year of French. So, and wow. but they were tracking kids too, mm-hmm. so. If you were on a particular track, there were these things available. They informed you in the summertime about these programs that were available. And the same summer that I went to St. Olaf for science, I was offered a chance to go to France to study French, Aix-en-Provence. My parents couldn't afford that, and there wasn't enough money mm-hmm. for me to go. Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter. I had an interest in both languages mm-hmm. and science. The school was very, very helpful, Kamehameha schools, mm-hmm. in terms of exposing us to what was possible out there. Mm-hmm. The college counselor had been, I think, with the admissions at Redlands University, was familiar with a whole mm-hmm. bunch of places, and if he wasn't and you found something that you were interested in, he would give them a call and talk mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of help getting us to where we wanted to be. And not everyone wanted to go to college, mm-hmm. but certainly there was a lot of help through the school. Three of my classmates got military academy appointments. Mm-hmm. So it was, I'm always grateful to the schools for having mm-hmm. done what they did, mm-hmm. pointing me in the right direction.
How did you go from math and physics to law school?
The interesting thing is, and I tell this sometimes to kids who are looking at going to college, because the college will ask you to declare a major when you're entering at freshman year, and mm-hmm. you have absolutely no idea mm-hmm. what's out there. Mm-hmm. You get to right. college and you think, oh my gosh, there are mm-hmm. all these classes you never even heard of, and all these areas, and they're exciting, and you want to take them all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the smorgasbord out there, and you mm-hmm. want to go pick everything at mm-hmm. the same time. But declare a major, you have to, and most of us, myself and kids, will usually pick something that they enjoy, that they like, or that they did well in high school, because mm-hmm. you don't want to fail mm-hmm. college, you know. So I did well in math, and I was fascinated by physics. Mm. And so I declared those as my majors. And like I said, with the math, I had enough. In 2 years, I had the requirements taken care of. The physics I stuck with and thought I wanted to be a research physics. In hindsight, I think part of that was rebelling mm-hmm. against my relatives who said, oh, you're going mm-hmm. to teach?
Oh, of course.
I said, no, I'm yeah. not going to teach. Uh-huh. I'm going to be a research scientist. Uh-huh. You know? Of course, the Chinese side of the family never gave up. They would always, every time I'd come home and they'd tell me, oh, you're going to marry a nice Chinese boy, doctor, lawyer, engineer. And I'd say, why can't I be the doctor or the lawyer or the engineer? And then they shut up. But
so you did have that rebellious aspect a bit.
I tried not to let it show too much. I had to bite my tongue a lot. But
it was there.
It was there, and now that we're talking about it, it's probably why my brothers and sisters used to stand by me when my dad was grilling us about mm-hmm. something, and they would poke me and say, don't say anything, don't say anything, because they knew if I did, it would be misinterpreted as disrespectful and sassy. Uh-huh. So, but yeah. My reasoning was, if I was right, then somebody had to hear it, and somebody should uh-huh. know it. It didn't always work.
Yeah. These words, disrespectful and sassy. Did they have continued on down.
Yeah. Well, as my dad would say, as long as you live in my house, you will live by my rules. Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, Dad.
So did you live your Kahu'iwai name with, you know, either something coming or the natural event, disaster, or anything? Have you ever felt a connection to it from that way?
I try not to think about it. I think if it's going to happen, it's going mm-hmm. to happen, despite my moods and what's happening around mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. I have been curious from time to time when something happens. I try to think back as to what was going on in my life at that time, particularly mm-hmm. when they're highly disastrous with mm-hmm. some very, very tragic outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so I feel bad mm-hmm. for all of that. But I also don't think that's anything I can do something about. I'm just the messenger, yeah. The omen, the sign, the whole ailona, as the Hawaiians would say.
That's a pretty powerful statement. I am the messenger, or the whole ailona, or of the whole ailona. That's big. Do you have any stories about a time where you were a messenger or showing the whole ailona?
Not that I can recall. There may have been sometimes, but I mm-hmm. try not to think about it. There was a time when my father sat me down and said, you need to know that our family Aumakua, our family god, was the shark, and he told me the story behind it, and he said, I'm telling this to you because you need to know it. It is part of you. But we are Christian and we worship you know, the Lord and Jesus. But it doesn't take away from who we are and that sort of genetic makeup that makes us who we are.
The stories that are yours. It is interesting that many Hawaiians were able, and I guess even Native American Indians too, successful in living both simultaneously, mm-hmm. the Christian life and then their cultural mm-hmm. history as well. Mm-hmm. And your dad seems very schooled, and I don't mean that formally, but very aware of his history, interested in it. It was important to him, mm-hmm. it sounds like. And would he have gotten this from this handsome grandfather over here, Kalaikini?
I think he got a lot of it from my grandfather. The book that I showed you earlier with my grandfather's writing, those are writings that take up the front part of the book. My dad has scribbled other things in the later part of the book, including some prayers as well. Mm-hmm. Some observations about the family. So I think that gives me the sense that my grandfather would have left the book for my father, who then decided at some point to take it up and continue the thoughts.
Well, that's also a source of this duality, right? And he actually was preaching, right? Leading a congregation in Christianity, and yet your dad is very aware of the cultural part, your name, the shark, all of that.
Yeah, I believe that my father wanted us to respect our culture. But he saw that society was changing around us, and he did not want us to be at a disadvantage. Which is perhaps one reason why both my parents did not teach us their native languages. And yet, my father took us to church, which was all in Hawaiian. Every single part of it was in Hawaiian until I was maybe in high school. And the pastor that had been there while I was growing up passed away, and a new younger pastor came on board who knew some Hawaiian but wasn't fluent enough. So they changed the service so that the first change was to have first service be all in Hawaiian, second service all in English. And because of dwindling congregation size, eventually it became one service that was a combination of Hawaiian and English.
Did your grandfather preach in Hawaiian?
Yes.
Did you ever hear him?
No. Mm. He had passed before I was older.
Did you ever hear stories of how he balanced his Hawaiian and Christianity aspects together? Well, I guess that's part of not really talking about the ancestors or the past. Mm-hmm. Mm.
It would have been nice to know some of that. At least in hindsight for me, there are eight children in our family. Three from my dad's first marriage and the five of us from my mom. There are four boys and four girls. I always felt different than my siblings. Not that I was necessarily, but I always felt different. And even the sharing by my dad was to me, not to my siblings.
He chose you to tell these things too.
To pass some of this on. And I now try to pass it on to all of my nieces and nephews as much as possible.
I guess the fact that he was passing is also somewhat indicative, passing this information that he knew it and he regarded it as important enough to share is indicative of your grandpa as well. There must have been some kind of quality like that.
I believe so.
In a way, this is a big stretch, but this is what came to me. It's kind of attorney-like, right? Being able to hold multiple perspectives. And yes, they lived and integrated.
Yes and no. You asked me earlier about making that transition. And I'll tell you that when I went to graduate school, what happened to physics was it just shrunk itself down to knowing everything about like zirconium 12 or something, and nothing about anything else. At the same time, I had to teach. I taught recitation and lab sessions. I remember having, this was back in the 70s, so here these companies were sending people back to school who had not gone to school earlier because of the war or whatever had gone on. And there's this gentleman in the back of the room, and he's probably in his mid-40s, and he's sitting there like this. And it was like, I dare this young whippersnapper female to teach me something. It was engineering physics, and they needed to take it to get their engineering degree. And at first, I thought, oh, this is going to be tough. And then I thought, no, we're just going to do what we're going to do. And when he finally had to come to my office for help, we got along fine after that. But it, you know, there are always challenges. But I love teaching. And I did not like being isolated in a lab, focused on this one little. I did high energy and solid state physics. So watching ions collide or, you know, dealing with different gases and whatever. And so I stopped with my master's. I had originally planned to get a PhD in physics, and I stopped. And I got my teaching certificate instead, and taught in the Des Moines public school system in Iowa.
Did your Chinese family know this part?
What's that?
Did your Chinese family know this part? Oh, look, she did it.
They eventually found out, and they smiled. But anyway, I taught everything from gifted sixth graders through college kids. Then there came a time when I was single. I was hanging around with a lot of single females. We had this Thursday night dinner club. We figured, we're all single. We never eat well, you know. So every Thursday night, we would rotate. Someone would host. You could try out recipes. Nobody could say anything bad about what was happening. You just ate, but you got to try out new recipes. So we did that. The members of that went on for like 13 years.
Wow.
That group.
How fun.
I joined it. It was already in process, and then I was there. But they started having problems with the legal system and with attorneys, both in their professional life, either in their professional life or in their personal life. And I said, geez, there's something about the law that, you know, we don't know and we should. And I was getting a little restless. It was time to do something else. So I decided to go to law school. You know, here I am today. Okay, let's look it up, apply to these law schools. Okay. I went to the University of Connecticut for law school, partly because it had, at the time, and this was in 1979, 50% women. Yes,
wow.
I wanted to go there.
Yeah.
They had, the average incoming age was 28. Yes, these people were all coming back the second time. And they had both a day program and an evening program. So you could get done in 3 years, which was the standard, or you could get done in 4 years. My property professor would say, you could tell which ones were the tenants and which ones were the landlords.
You know,
the ones that were working hard. In any event, that's how I got to law school. And I got to that particular one because I said, where haven't I lived before? And I traveled out east, but I never lived there. So I said, we should go out east. So I did that. In hindsight, you know, I thought, oh, you should have chosen a name school, a better school. I said, no, I'm where I'm supposed to be. I had applied to about four or five schools, got accepted, all of them except with GW, George Washington with that I really wanted to go to. I was on a waiting list. Uh-huh. And the week before classes started at Connecticut, they called me. And I said, you know, I've already accepted at Connecticut. I think I'll just fulfill that commitment. Thank you. And in hindsight, I think, maybe I should have done that. It's all water under the bridge.
So how did you end up making the circle back to Lahaina as an attorney?
Okay. I finished law school. And during law school, you clerk in the summer somewhere. And so I had clerked several places. I wanted to do a judicial clerkship the year after law school. And I had enjoyed my time in Iowa. I wanted to move back to Iowa. It wasn't time for me to come home yet. So I clerked for a federal magistrate in the Southern District of Iowa. And then I became a federal prosecutor. And then both my parents were ill. So after 3 years, it was time to come home after 3 years with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I came home in January of 86. My dad passed in June of 86. My mother did not pass till like 2009. She hung in there, you know, it was good. I came back, went with a private firm, actually the third largest firm in Honolulu, as a litigator, as a trial attorney, civil trial attorney. Became a partner after 4 years. This law firm was called Case & Lynch. It had offices on all the islands. Mm-hmm. They needed a litigation partner on Maui. And so I said, okay, I'll go. I had nothing to tie me to Honolulu, except my family, but I knew they'd always be there. So it was another adventure. Okay, let's go to Maui. So I came to Maui as a trial attorney. That would be in 1991, 92, 91. And then the firm that had been like 107 years old decided to dissolve. There were 35 of us partners, I think maybe three women at the time. And the folks in the Lahaina office, there were at the time, I think three or four partners. We decided we liked working with each other. So we just changed the name on the door and on the stationery. We kept going. And then I got restless again.
What was the name?
That was when I joined. The new name. Yeah. Mancini, Rowland, and Welch.
Oh, okay.
You familiar
with
the firm?
Yes. Yes.
And in 98, it was time to do something else. And there was an ad in the paper for a vice president position at Maui Land and Pineapple, Kapalua Land Company division. And so I applied and became vice president of administration there, which is basically doing legal work in the personnel, HR, security, homeowner relations, all of that stuff. So I went with them, and I was with Kapalua. I was vice president of administration first, and then was general counsel for them later.
Was any of this in the David Cole days?
Oh yes, uh-huh. It started with Don Young, uh-huh. and then David Cole came on board, and not too long after that they started downsizing, really downsizing at the corporate, the overall corporate level, Maui Land and Pine. And then eventually Kapalua Land Company, which is one I was associated with. But I learned a lot. I developed a lot of skills there and did a lot of homeowner relations stuff. Also looked at a lot of maps, some of which had Isaac Davis's name on it, my ancestor. And that kind of stirred things a little that way. And his daughter, Kali Davis, is buried out on that end. That would be his daughter from the first wife, and then George, my ancestor, and Becky are from the second. in any event, we were there, and then the downsizing eventually got to where they said, we're going to send all our legal work out. We're not keeping the legal department. So I opened my own firm in Lahaina.
And when you went to go work out there, did you know about your Maui roots at that time, or did you discover it through this map work?
That was part of my discovery of, I'd like to say, who I am, or those components of my life that contribute to a lot of who I am.
Amazing.
It is amazing. Mm-hmm. It is. It blows me away sometimes to think about it. So I think about my brothers and sisters who either don't have an interest in where we come from, or might want to know, but they don't have that same exposure to finding that. One of my sisters worked for the Department of Health at one time in the vital records and vital statistics. So she did some searching on the family. And so that was good.
But Candy.
She's passed. Yeah.
So. I was in a conversation this morning with someone who talked about what she called moments of grace. That, you know, I might think of them more as like some kind of destiny moment where you are, this thing happens and it sets you on a path that when you look back, it seems so intentional. Right? Maybe you were not actively moving that way along it, but then you end up in this place where it brings you to who you are in a way that your other family don't have.
Yeah, I think about it in a similar way, except that I tend to look at the disappointing moments as being actually those little nudges to get back onto this other path. You know, you try for a job, you really want that job, but then, you know, you don't get it. And so it forces you to look somewhere else. And there's a reason you didn't get it. It's, you're off the path, you know, and someone's putting you back on it.
Where's your path going now?
That's an interesting question. In 2017, my husband and I moved from the west side to Wailuku because we tell everybody it's because we were getting old. He was already retired. I was going to retire. We needed to be closer to the airport and the hospital, so we came to Wailuku. But I haven't, I'll say the positive is, I did get rid of all those paying clients. I continued to do work for the court, and I do work for nonprofit groups, a lot of churches. I have developed a stronger and stronger interest in equal justice for everyone. I volunteer at the self-help center at the courthouse. So where's the path? Whatever it is, it sounds to me and feels to me like the path is giving back to the community that help you become what you are. Yeah, you don't need any more money at this stage in life. Yeah, you have lots of friends, some of whom are passing on, you know, on their own. But there are so many people and groups that struggle to be less than, to be more than on the margins of society. And they need the help. So you try to do what you can.
So your work is largely volunteer now? Or is it all volunteer?
It's largely volunteer. Interestingly enough, there are some nonprofits that have grants that will allow them to pay for some legal help along the way, and so they, if they can, then they'll pay some. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they just say, no, we really value your time. And so we want to pay you, we can't pay you your regular rate, but we really would like to. So we work something out.
We've had really an amazing and remarkable life. And I know that our time is almost up. But one thing I wanted to come back to is, did you ever go back to Kalaupapa and find your family?
I have not yet gone back to Kalaupapa. But I have shared a lot of this with my... a lot of the information I've gathered about our Kalaupapa family with my nieces and nephews. I have two nieces who grew up on Oahu and then married Molokai boys. Oh. So they have raised families on Molokai. One of them is currently at Kalaupapa working for the National Park Service in their agricultural side. And her oldest son is on Oahu, but in the summertime goes back and works at Kalaupapa. And so they are doing some of the legwork in terms of trying to find information about the relatives, the ancestors. So, yeah.
And soon you should be able to go, right? In terms of who's being allowed mm-hmm. to come in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Do you remember this lady that worked for the Maui News? I can see her in my mind, just big
blonde?
Curly hair. Yeah,
Valerie.
Valerie
Munson.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's head up. Have you talked with her about your
I
relatives?
I did. When I first learned about having relatives or ancestors there, I did contact the...
like Friends of Kalaupapa or
yes.
something like that.
And spoke with Valerie as uh-huh. well. They could not find any records. And I sent them what I had, in particular the medical report that had been done. And I have since found that Mikona, the father, had a number. He was patient number 124. So I know they're there. Uh-huh. My grandnephew says that he tried to look for a gravestone for him and did not find one. He said, but some of the early ones, or the ones that passed in the early years, and this ancestor was in that group, were put in a mass grave. Mm-hmm. And so there are no individual headstones. And he, Makana is saying he thinks that
he's inside
that
yeah.
may be where he, and I, as I understand it, the three children that were with him, may have made it to adulthood, but not very far into. So they may have passed on in their 20s or something. They were young.
Have you ever read the biography of Marianne Cope?
No.
Okay. I will. I think I still have it. And if I do, I'll pass it on to you.
Oh, that would be good.
It's very fascinating about her time there. Well, even on Oahu, too.
Uh-huh.
And just... aspects of Hansen's disease that, you know, we never think of, or we never knew, or thank you so much, Caroline, for a time. I really could do this forever. I think it's fascinating. I think it's important. Mm-hmm. I hope it's also good for you to be thinking of all these things and sharing them.
It surprises me, because I didn't think we would be able to fill up the time.
Oh my gosh.
But
essentially, we started with one question, you know, of the ones that we talked about, right? Every question could just keep going on and on. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. You,
for sure.
You did well asking questions and following up.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.